From the Draco Vista Studios in Phoenix, Arizona, unlocking secrets of writing, conversing with masters of the craft, and just having a lot of fun. It's the Dragon Page, cover to cover.
And welcome to another Dragon Page cover to cover. I'm Michael R. Menengay.
And I am Michael Stackpole.
On Skype again.
Right. I'm in Scottsdale.
You are a busy, busy guy. Well, you're in Scottsdale, and then you're going to be in Vegas, and then you're going to be back in Scottsdale. So you are a world traveler, I tell you.
Just a jet setter. unfortunately, when you have books pile up on each other,
yeah,
exactly. even a cross town commute is a little more time than you can afford. So.
Well, that's all right. That's all right. We got a great interview with Kevin J. Anderson and Brian Herbert that is coming up in a little bit. And you were in Vegas for that. But yep. Very, very, very cool stuff. Hey, we put this show out even if we're not around to put the show out. So I'm expecting to do this for my bathtub one day.
Okay. Thank you for that image. I will never get it out of my mind.
I didn't say I was going to run video during it. I was just saying. I can always take a microphone.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say we actually have a really cool comment that came into the studio. Question, actually. And I thought it was really relevant and a good way to open the show up. So,
hi, this message is for the guys at Dragon Page. I don't know if you've covered this already, but can you please talk about Amanda Hawking and what you think, your thoughts on that? Because I think it's big news. And anyway, I love your show. Thank you. Bye.
It is big news, and I really wanted to get this conversation in before the shows get too far out and we get too old, because it is pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, that comment actually may have been prior to the latest news about Amanda Hawking. But just to recap for everybody, Amanda Hawking is a success story in terms of the realm of self-publishing over the internet. Mm-hmm. She's had, I think, 6 or 7 books that have done very, very well via the Kindle. She really is pitching straight to that Stephanie Meyer demographic, and mm-hmm. they are reacting big time. The most recent news, which happened just last week, was that Hawking signed I believe it's a 4-book deal. Mm-hmm. With a traditional publisher for about $2 million.
Yeah. Nice big advance on that one. So it's a
nice big advance on that one.
I don't know. I think there's two parts of this that I would like to have a conversation about. And the one is that we're kind of having right now, and that is basically she's self-published and so forth.
Right.
The second one is the advance and the deal that she got. I would love to have a conversation of how much was that the writing and how much is that the success of her blog and the community that she has built, because the girl knows how to network online.
The answer is, I think, when you read the interviews with her, she's very forthright about saying, hey, look, one, she worked her butt off.
Yes, she did. Two, I'm not taking any of that away from
her. No, not at all. No, and she acknowledges that, one, she worked her butt off, and two, she acknowledges that, you know, lightning struck.
Yeah.
You know, that she got lucky, she caught lightning in a bottle, and there she is.
Mm-hmm.
But to your point of what does New York think it's buying when it buys her,
mm-hmm.
is I think you've got answers C and answers D. One, in answer C, they're hoping that the fans who've bought the books digitally, will translate over into counterparts who would be willing to buy those books in print form. So they're really kind of hoping. But you notice that she didn't sell them the books that she's already written. This is for new books.
Exactly. Right? And that is a very key and very savvy move on her part, I think.
Right. And I think the second thing is that, you know, answer D in your multiple choice questions may be that this is a serious amount of cover your ass.
Mm.
that the traditional publishers are seeing just how far down the road we're going or we've gone, mm-hmm. and bang, you know, all of a sudden, this is a big, they realize how deep they're in. I mean, I'll give you because I've been compiling numbers on my own sales of books on the Kindle. And we're talking about sales of novel length works, the things that I charge $5 or $6 for.
Mm-hmm.
Between December and January, the average daily sales doubled.
Wow.
Okay, doubled. And between February and March, they took another 40%, or actually it's about a 45% jump.
Hmm.
Okay, and the damnable thing of it is, I cannot figure out what I did to trigger that sort of a jump.
I'm not sure you did anything. I have a feeling that the real answer there is the one I think you were about to say, and that is that it's just starting to perpetually move that direction.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think the momentum is building, and we're going to see more and more of this stuff start to escalate as more people find it, more people get savvy with the electronic devices that are available, because the Kindle and the Nook and these readers have been out there for a while, but there's a little lag time there. Everybody keeps looking at the launch of the electronic device as when the whole thing starts. No, it's really, really not, people. The reality is, if you look at all the history of the really groundbreaking devices, the cell phone and the CD and all these other things that have come out, and now we look back at them and go, oh my God, that changed the world. It took a while for that to ramp up, not because of the sales, because of the learning curve and the people, the consumers who bought them. Because they buy the devices, they look at them, they play with them, they put a couple pictures on them, they kind of format and font, and then it's like about a few months to a year down the road, all of a sudden they discovered the device for the first time. And it's like, oh, I can use this to X. I can use this to play music. I can use this to watch movies. I can use this to read books. And it's that aha moment with the consumer getting used to the device that they purchased that all this stuff kind of ramps up and things start to explode. And I think that's what we're seeing here.
I think you are absolutely right. Look, the one thing that gets said to me over and over and over again when people come up and they've got their Kindle or they've got their iPad or they've got their Nook, especially people that I talked to before they ever bought those devices,
mm-hmm.
all these people come up to me and they say, yeah, I know. I was one of the ones who said to you I would never go away from books.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I got this for my birthday. And now I wouldn't go anywhere without it.
Yep.
Yep. And you are absolutely correct. It is the point when novelty moves to familiarity.
Yes.
When you are comfortable with those functions, all of a sudden you start exploring all the possibilities that there are there.
Yep.
And this is what takes you further afield than anything else. And we're certainly seeing this. We're seeing it with the iPads. You know, people will get in through whatever vector they get in through. I mean, I wanted a computer that would do, you know, that I could work on while I was on the road.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, I use it as an ebook reader. I use it for watching movies. I use it for playing games.
Yeah.
I never used to play games, but you know, now I play games. And so, you know, these are the things that once you get comfortable with it, these are the things that you enjoy. These are the things that you keep going back to. And we are definitely seeing that. And look, you know, Amanda Hocking is making the jump in the correct direction for her.
Mm-hmm.
And as you pointed out, she is being absolutely brilliant. She is keeping her bread and butter stuff already on electronics, and she's allowing New York to buy her stuff for a lot of money, and it was World English rights.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's very, very important. She did not sell all world rights, so her agent can turn around now and go that and sell that set of books in Germany. They can go and sell that set of books all over the world. So she's going to be making a boatload of money. And then we've got Barry Eisler, who is a New York Times bestselling thriller writer, who turned around and turned down $500,000 advance for two novels.
That was the other story that I was debating on whether or not we wanted to bring up today. But that's huge. The fact that he turned it down is just staggering. And that should have sent more of a shockwave through the publishing industry than what we were hearing.
Well, actually, if you look at the Hawking story and the Eisler story, mm-hmm. the Eisler story broke, and then all of a sudden there was news released that Hawking was getting close to closing a deal.
Mm-hmm.
When was the last time prior to this that you heard an author was close to closing a deal?
Good point.
Yeah, never.
Yeah.
So that was disinformation to get out there to buck up the publishing troops and to buck up everybody else and say, oh, no, look, somebody who's a champion of self-publishing is going to come over and play for us.
Yeah.
See, we are on the right side of things.
It is interesting times that we live in right now. And for all you folks out there who are wanting to be authors and publishing and going down this road and still having thoughts and dreams of traditional publishing, there's good to be said on both sides. We're not discounting anything. We're not saying that traditional publishing is evil and bad and not a way to go if you can make the right deal. But at the same time, boy, you got a lot more options out there.
And the key thing, which you just said, is the right deal. You have to be looking at that deal, and you have to run all of the numbers.
Yes.
And if you don't run all of the numbers, you're going to make a bad decision one way or the other.
Right.
And look, you run all the – as long as you're making an informed decision, nobody's going to second guess you.
No. And I think it's exciting stuff. So, but we got to get to our interview. This is a great conversation. But, I'm sure we're going to have a lot more about this as the issues develop.
Without a doubt.
All right, folks. Hang tight. We'll be right back with Kevin and Brian.
This is Web Genie with an audiobook review for Dragon Page Cover to Cover. And this review is a little bit different from many, since I have no intention of telling you the title of the book or the author's name. This is in keeping with the Dragon Page policy of don't publicize a book you hate. But this book raises some interesting questions that I want to explore without outing the book. To start off with, I look forward to receiving the arc of this book. It had a great cover. It is in a genre I enjoy, urban paranormal romance, and according to the jacket copy, it was funny. It even had a track record. It was the second book in a series, so that's a good sign too. Hold on there, Web Genie. Don't get too excited. By page 20, I was struggling. By page 40, I was annoyed. And by page 80, I gave up. But what is interesting is how this book failed. First, it wasn't funny. The style of humor the author was attempting, a la Mary Janice Davidson, is one of those things that looks simple, but is actually tricky to pull off. Here it failed because the Mary Sue insert of the author prevented me from bonding with the heroine. The snarky humor style requires that the snark be things that the reader wants to say. As an author, if you want to pull off this style, you can't insert yourself in between the reader and the heroine. You need to let the light shine on your character so that she speaks for the reader and not yourself. Then we, as readers, can feel all warm, fuzzy, and witty is that the character is saying all these things that we totally would say in that situation. Second, the romance element. I've seldom felt a flatter romance. Now, to be fair, I was joining the series in the second book, so perhaps much of the characterization happened in the previous book. However, characterization should be a continual process, not an item on a checklist, addressed once and never returned to. Our heroine kept saying how much she loves the hero and that she'd do him in the elevator, the car, the office, or any other locale. But the author never shows us how all this passion makes a character feel. As a result, the heroine might as well be talking about getting a manicure or going shopping. Third, let's talk about shopping. The relentless product name dropping. Ah. In Dragon Page 437, Trampas was asking about product placement. You know, in the right hands, mentioning real-world products really helped to ground a story and make it more believable. And then there's what happens in the wrong hands. In this book, the author substitutes products for characterization to a distracting and annoying level. Specifically, all the men in the book were repeatedly described as wearing Armani. I couldn't tell you if the hero was blonde or brunette, but he was wearing Armani, as were the legions of other men lusting after the heroine. This kind of luxury product characterization is so annoying. Honestly, I wouldn't recognize an Armani suit if it bit me, because, you know, all men's suits kind of look alike anyway. Isn't that the point of a suit? If she'd described a good-looking man in a well-fitting suit, that is in my realm of experience, and I can relate to that. The odd part of this is that I believe the author can write. These faults could have been corrected by the editor. So, Web Genie says, lovers of urban paranormal comedy romance, beware. A great cover doesn't necessarily mean a great read.
And welcome back to more Dragon Page Cover to Cover. I'm Michael Armenegay.
And I am Michael Stackpole.
And joining us on the phone, we have none other than Kevin J. Anderson and Brian Herbert. If you don't know who these guys are, you need to crawl out from under your rock.
Right, well, the sand or something like that.
Yeah, something like that, exactly. How are you doing, Kevin? How are you doing, Brian?
Good, thank you.
Awesome.
We've been running around all day yesterday and all day today signing our new book, and we're taking a break to relax, talk to you for 5 minutes, then running off to do it again.
Okay, well, tell us very quickly about that new book, because all our listeners are going to have to slow this down to listen to it, because we're going to try and cram 15 minutes into about 7.5.
Yeah.
Cool. Kevin drinks more coffee. Go ahead,
okay,
Kevin.
our new book is called Hellhole, and this is, Brian and I have done 11 Dune novels together over the past 11 years, and this is our first non-Dune novel. So it's an original universe, big science fiction epic about a planet that has been struck by an extinction event asteroid about 400 or 500 years before the story starts. So it's a mess. There's seismic events and volcanoes and storms, and most of the ecosystem's been wiped out. So it's just the place where all the misfits and religious fanatics and outlaws and the people that you don't want to live in civilized society, they try to make a home for themselves. But then, of course, they find some remnants of an alien civilization, and we've got a corrupt galactic government and dozens of characters and an exiled general, and it's like trying to describe the book on Twitter. You can't really do it in 140 characters or less.
And we've got instantaneous space travel and communication in a very new way.
Nice, nice, nice.
That's all in the first chapter.
That's great.
It's a long chapter.
I have to say, when I saw the title, the first thing that came to my mind was Spinal Tap.
we're looking to recruit them for the soundtrack if we can,
or a dental visit. Yeah.
I was just going to suggest that you stole my bit. That's what I was going
to
say. So when the movie comes out, you've got to do
7.5 minutes instead of 15. So I had to steal your stuff.
We're going to start asking the questions that you would have asked.
Oh, okay. Well,
the heck with it, guys. Don't let us ask any questions. Just give us the answers.
There we go.
Well, you know, we like to say that we have had millions of our Dune books sold, and we figured that, you know, we've learned how to do this, and we wanted to really explore a new universe of our own. And I've done a whole bunch of my own original science fiction stuff. Brian's done a bunch of his own. So we wanted to just have complete free reign and make up all kinds of cool stuff and throw it into a book. It's a trilogy, so this is book one, and we're plotting book two right now during this tour.
And on this misfit planet, we have a Napoleon-like general who's led a great revolution against the monarchy that runs the multi-planet galactic empire. And this guy's been exiled, sort of like Napoleon to St. Elba. He first escaped to Elba, and then he went to St. Helena.
Right.
So he's in exile, and he's forming a brand new revolution. Surprise! They should have killed him in the first place. But they didn't, and he's going to get even. And there's like 54 planets in the deep zone where... and one of them is Hellhole. And so this Napoleon character finds a way to get all the leaders of these remote planets in the deep zone into a great war against the rest of the monarchy.
And this guy's our good guy, we should say. So mm-hmm. He doesn't sound like it, but he's pretty much our hero.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So what drove you guys toward doing this? Was it one of the things where you came up with some characters and say, hey, we need a background that's going to allow us to explore some of these issues? Or was it, you know, examining the whole science fiction thing of a post-impact world and that sort of thing? Or what was it? What were the genesis of this book?
Yeah, Kevin and I had talked about writing another series or another novel together, and he sent me a one-page letter regarding this planet that had been blasted by an asteroid, and this extinction event then would kill everything bigger than about 2 feet tall. So there isn't supposed to be much left, and so then we decided to set something even more bizarre in that setting. And when Kevin and I start brainstorming, one of us will come up with an idea and the other will build on it. It's sort of like a jazz performance, and we riff off each other. And by the time we got finished with the brainstorming, I mean, it was huge. So just from that kernel of an idea, we built this huge empire.
Well, we thought that the post-impact planet would be a very interesting place not to live if we were really living there, but to throw characters into and make them suffer and have all
sure.
kinds of problems. And that was the first idea, and then what if there was an alien civilization that was there beforehand that got nearly wiped out? And then we started talking, well, who on earth would go there? And then we came up with this Napoleon-type guy and some other misfits. And as you create the characters, then you think of things for them to do in the plot, and when they do things in the plot, then they come up with other characters to meet, and it just blossoms all over the place into a big... it's a substantial book with lots of storylines and characters, and we think that the people who like our Dune novels or My Seven Sons books or Brian's Time Web books should be pleased with it.
So can you describe the process for collaboration? Because different authors do it differently together. How do you two work together?
Well, first we come up with a kernel of an idea, and then we will lay out a lot of ideas that we exchange by email or fax or phone call. And then we physically get together and we'll go on little hikes and brainstorm with notepads or a tape recorder. And we just keep fleshing it out and building until we have around generally 100 chapters per book or a little more. And then Kevin will take the 50 of the chapters that may specialize more in space travel or scientific elements. I'll take maybe 50 chapters that have to do more with philosophical or religious or political elements or female lead characters. And I'll write the first draft on those. Kevin will write the first draft on the other. So we have 100 chapters written simultaneously because we both write very fast on the first draft. And so then at that point, we turn it over either to him or to me to go through the whole 100 chapters. And then it goes back and forth. And so, for example, on Sisterhood of Dune, which is our next Dune novel, Kevin just completed looking at the entire book on the fifth draft right before the book tour, and of course he hands it to me to work on during the book tour. So I'm sitting in the back of the car while we're being driven from bookstore to bookstore, and I'm working on the manuscript, and Kevin's up there just drinking coffee and having fun.
So that's
well, there you go.
So it sounds good to me. So you are going to have to slow this interview down. I've never heard Brian give that description of a collaborative process that fast before.
Hey, look, I'm just saying, it sounds great. Brian, do you have any brothers at home that want to work with me? Because I work that way. I don't have a problem with that.
Well, I have a nephew that's a writer, Byron Merritt, and yeah, he might want to work with him.
Yeah, well, what Mike's saying is that he wants somebody to do all the work in the back seat of the car while he gets to relax up in the front seat.
Well, if that was Mike Stackpole, I know that you can write 60,000 words in about 60 minutes. So.
Yeah, that's it.
You don't need anybody to help you.
Wow. Well, you brought up an interesting point and something that I'd seen out on the web, and it was the speculation that since you have done this new collaboration, that the Dune series may be coming to an end. Any truth to that rumor?
Well, we've just now finished The Sisterhood of Dune, which is the first book in a trilogy that's set 10,000 years before Dune. It's right after the end of the Butlerian Jihad, about 80 years after that. And it's about the formation of the Bene Gesserit Sisterhood, the Mentats, the Spacing Guild, and the Navigators, the Doctors. It's the formation of all like the great schools in the Dune universe. And we just finished the first draft. But what we've, after writing 11 Dune books in a row, 11 years in a row, we're going to now do it every other year, and then we'll do a Hellhole book in the alternate year. So that's two trilogies that we're sort of hopscotching right now. So people will still get to, we've got at least three more Dune books that we're planning to do, and then all three Hellhole books. So that takes us out 6 years from now. That's probably as far enough ahead as we want to plan at the moment. So ask us in 5.5 years what we want to do next.
But each one of the books we do, whether it's Dune or Hellhole, it needs to be a substantial book, and it's not just inserting a book in that particular year. We feel a lot of responsibility to maintain good storylines.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the world is ending in 2012, so I mean...
That's right. We've got to get them all published before
then. Well, we've got to get printed fast then.
That's right.
The Mayan calendar, yeah.
Well, Hellhole could be, what is it, you know, a prophecy novel for 2012 plus 300-400 years.
And think of how well our sales will be if the Earth really is destroyed by something like that.
Absolutely.
Our sales go right through the roof.
Kevin just
always an optimist.
Kevin's always blowing up planets and he sees another opportunity here.
Yeah.
I'm telling you.
Hey, you have to have something to read when the entire civilization is wiped out. You know, that's just the way it is.
So don't buy any Christmas presents next year if the world's going to end on December 21st because, you know, you can't return them afterwards.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, you guys are scaring me. But this is good because, I mean, you know, that's part of the charm of books is getting that scare factor in. When you guys are working on the books, whether they're the Dune books or this, do you consciously pay any attention to what critics might say and occasionally think, oh, and I'll do this just to prove so-and-so wrong? Or do you just operate outside that sort of critical framework and just not worry about that at all?
Kind of in between. I mean, we think about our worst critics and they are out there, and we try very hard to please them while knowing we never can.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But we also try to have like a wide range of test readers go over the books, people who are expertise in certain things. And obviously we do the very best job that we possibly can, but all you have to do is look on fan boards or Amazon reviews or something, and you can always find a critic who complains about anything. Just pick some random thing, and you'll find a critic who's complaining about it. So we can't possibly write our books to try to please the one person who says there's too much violence, and then the next person who says there's not enough violence. So you got to write the book that you want to write, and do what's true to your own vision of this stuff. And Brian and I really have the same vision most of the time on our books. And so far, thankfully, the vast majority of people are really enjoying what we're doing, and they keep buying them year after year.
Well, one of the reasons the Dune series has lasted in comparison with other big series and famous science fiction novels is because the other novels have gone out of date on their technology, whereas Dune, at the time of that novel, there are no legal computers. And basically every character is a form of a human, a mutation, whether it's a navigator or a mentat or whatever. So it's about human potential. And so we're thinking of that when we're writing Hellhole, where we have these fantastic, interesting settings, but it's also primarily about people and how they survive in these difficult environments.
Do you ever find
the Hellhole environment is about as difficult as the Hellhole book tour environment these days? We're doing 13 cities in 16 days, and we've done 7 bookstores already today and talked to Google, and this is our second interview. We got another one later on tonight. So it's as glamorous as you might think. We just got into our very nice hotel room, and we're going to leave in 5 minutes. So it's what we do to promote the book, because it's hard enough work to write the book in the first place. We want people to go out and read it.
Right, and now you guys are in Denver right now?
Seattle right now.
Seattle right now, okay.
Yeah, I live in Seattle, and Brian and Kevin lives in near Denver.
Right.
Very nice.
And then Portland tomorrow, and then San Francisco, and L.A., and San Diego, and then keep going.
Well, I appreciate you taking your time out of a busy schedule and in between your jaunts between bookstores to talk with us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah.
And next time the beer is on Mike.
Yeah, that's it.
I which Mike I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, Stackpole, he just won money. So he
yeah. I mean, I'm in Vegas right now, so I just won money, so apparently I'm buying.
Yeah, he's buying. Hmm.
Cool.
Okay, congratulations.
All right, guys. Thanks. It's always a pleasure to talk to the Dragon Page. Thanks for talking to us again.
Not a problem. Okay. Enjoy your tour, guys.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Thanks.
All right. We'll be back with more Dragon Page right after this.
Optimal health is more than eating right.
You figure out, okay, here's what I'm allowing myself, calories, carbs, protein, and you spread it out. That way your body can actually absorb the nutrition properly, mm-hmm. and it can work in your favor because it's going to help you prevent muscle loss.
Good nutrition and the right exercise are the things that affect us all.
Yes, let's talk about back fat today. In fact, we could just title this episode Back Fat.
Join Romy Nelson, Ingredients for Life.
Visit RomyNelson.com.
All right, wrapping things up here on Dragon Page Cover to Cover. Let's figure out what do we do with this other story that I wanted to talk about. I don't want to get into it now because this is going to be a long discussion, but I just want to get this in here.
Well, let me just suggest, we can do that on the next show, but let me just suggest something. I have to give a talk this Saturday
mm-hmm.
to a group of people who sponsor scholarships for people who want to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions that I usually get, and I will probably get on Saturday, is, hey, if I'm going to college and I want to be a writer, what courses should I take?
And this should be a college course. It should be a college course. Absolutely.
Well, here's the interesting thing. I think right now my answer is going to be take business courses.
Yeah.
And my challenge to people who've got writers groups out there is it's great for you to have writers groups and it's great for you to be critiquing each other's work. And I think that that's fantastic and that's going to help you be better writers. But for the love of all that is holy, take at least one meeting every 2 months
mm-hmm.
and try and find somebody who understands small business.
Yeah, that's
and
good.
Have them talk to your group.
Yes, I think that is absolutely important because it truly is. If you're looking at your writing as a hobby and you as an artist and yada yada, you're missing the boat. I mean, I'm all for the artist thing. I'm all for the creativity thing. And I totally get that outlet that this fills you with some whatever sense of wonder that you've created something beautiful. But when it comes right down to it, it's still a business. And the successful artists, even the really, you know, dedicated artists are still really good business people at heart. I mean, when it comes down to it, that's what it is. It's marketing and business. You're still trying to sell your wares.
Absolutely. And I think, and again, you know, just what we were talking about earlier in the show, just watching this rising tide coming in and lifting all boats, having somebody with a little bit of business savvy
mm-hmm.
to come in and kind of acquaint you with some of the things that you may want, you need to know. I mean, anybody listening to this, you know, is either prepped their taxes or like me will be filing an extension and, you know, just knowing a little bit of tax law and what you can deduct and what you can't deduct
mm-hmm.
can save you a lot of money. And so I think I'm going to try that line out with them on this little speech that I have to give on Saturday and see what sort of reaction I get.
I tell you, probably one of the most used, re-referenced and utilized things I have ever done in my life was I took a semester of contract law. And oh my God, I have used that. I use that more than anything else I have ever learned.
There you
absolutely.
Go.
And it is so, so important. And anyway, we're going to get off onto a tangent and get into a longer conversation. But unfortunately, we are completely out of time. And that's going to do it for this show. You know the numbers, 206-350-READ. That's 206-350-7323. Please go to DragonPage.com. There's a lot of really cool stuff over there, a lot of reviews, a lot of books that you can buy, a lot of things that we cover in the library. It's just a great place to hang out. Go do that.
Yep, and see us in Second Life and buy books.
Absolutely. And we'll be back with more next week. Thanks so much for tuning in, everyone.
All right, bye-bye.